news tonight, more violence from police against water protectors in North Dakota.
Again, once again today, we are going through the violent actions by the police.
A journalist who reports on conflict areas shares what some Iraqis are saying about the U.S. election.
The push for the liberation of Mosul, while the Iraqi military was not prepared for, was being pushed by the Obama administration to help the Clinton campaign.
The Nation magazine held a symposium last night on media malpractice and the 2016 election.
Pay attention to what the heck is going on. And if you don't want to be a strategic third-party voter and you want to be a, you know, no matter what third-party voter, that is your choice. But some people don't even understand the distinction.
And New Yorkers are beginning to hold forums around the city to hear from community members on NYPD reform.
True reform is going to come from the people who are experiencing this violence, who are experiencing this oppression on a daily basis.
With these and other stories in New York, I'm Linda Perry, and this is some of the news for Wednesday, November 2nd, 2016. We'll begin with Standing Rock. As protests continue throughout the country in solidarity with the water protectors in North Dakota, a Standing Rock elder, Phyllis Young, says they are gathering support for the 400 people arrested so far over the last days. She says today police injured a protester with a rubber bullet which pierced his lungs, and they are very concerned about police tactics.
There was a bridge built by the Ochete Shakoi to at the river crossing where the proposed boring is going to take place. We let the people know that the boring place is still on private land, but we are on the shoreline of the federal Army Corps land. So they have reached there. We don't know when our federal court case will be held. Maybe 1 month, maybe 2 months, but we know that the company is trying to move forward with their development. And a group of youth council went to the river this morning, and a number of our people, and there was one shot with rubber bullets, and he was taken in an ambulance to Bismarck, North Dakota. So, Once again today, we are going through the violent actions by the police. And we know that the military is not involved here. The military are not allowed to be used against us as Indian people.
Meanwhile, President Barack Obama says the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is examining whether the four-state Dakota Access oil pipeline can be rerouted in southern North Dakota to alleviate the concerns of Native peoples. The 1,200-mile, $3.8 billion pipeline would carry oil from North Dakota through South Dakota and Iowa to a shipping point in Illinois. It would skirt the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation that straddles the North Dakota-South Dakota border. But the tribe elder says the group doesn't believe Obama.
We are aware that Obama says that the government may move the Dakota Access Pipeline away from sacred land. We don't believe that. We don't trust anyone. He didn't say anything final, but he said that the government could intervene to try and resolve the dispute. We have talked to the Army Corps of Engineers. As far as we know, we're trying to establish the truth that there is still no easement. We're trying to confirm that. We don't know, but we don't trust. It could be issued without us knowing it, but we know that this company will try to cross that river without that permit. We know that. And so we're at the crossing, and we believe that the permit, as far as we know, we're telling our people that the permit for the easement to cross the river has not been authorized.
And Phyllis Young says while Hillary Clinton's representative has met with them, no position from her campaign has emerged from the talks. Young says that the water protectors, though, at Standing Rock are very heartened by word of protests in solidarity around the country.
We are heartened by the response from all of America, which is very meaningful to us because it's critical that they be informed, that they be involved, because this affects all of Americans. Missouri River is the longest river. So in Kansas today, they are mobilizing five of their major cities for support, for donations. There's a large contingency of clergy who are coming from all over. There's 300 members of the clergy who have arrived here. We expect groups from California. We had groups that came in on Sunday from Ferguson, Missouri, Chicago, and Denver. So people are continuously coming here, getting informed. We're going to hold a conference for legal action. We're going to hold a round table on social justice and social change so that we can create criteria for social impact assessment, not only for Standing Rock and not only for Indian Country, but a social methodology for America, for all Americans to have a say. And if that development is occurring in our front yards.
Standing Rock Elder Phyllis Young. Thanks to WBAI's Earth Mom for staying in touch while she's in North Dakota. And you are listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Continuing on with international news, U.S.-backed Iraqi forces moved closer today to a town south of Mosul. A military statement said they breached the eastern limits of Mosul, the last major city stronghold for IS in Iraq. Aid groups and regional officials say IS executed dozens of prisoners. Currently, more than 5,000 U.S. troops are deployed in Iraq. Derek Flood is an independent journalist. He covers conflicts overseas. He's been doing this for the past 15 years. He's been to Iraq four times.
I like to revisit places over time to sort of see how these the conflicts transform and how they're, you know, whether things are any closer to any kind of resolution, which they often aren't.
Flood was on a panel this weekend on conflict war reporting at the New York Press Club's conference on the press and the 2016 election. After the panel, he shared a sense of what those in war-torn areas are saying about the U.S. election.
I can tell you just a little, an anecdote from a Peshmerga general that I interviewed on my last day in Nineveh Governorate, which is the province that surrounds, that encompasses Mosul. He told me that because people were sort of calling this the liberation of Mosul operation, this October surprise thing. So this Peshmerga general that I was interviewing actually said that he thought the Democratic National Committee was pushing for this quote-unquote October surprise to help get Hillary Clinton elected. The Kurdish fighters actually believe this. And it's really important what people fighting the wars believe. To us, and to a Westerner, it might sound like a conspiracy theory or a totally unfounded thing or something, or somewhere in between. But Iraqis that I interviewed actually believe that the push for the liberation of Mosul, while the Iraqi military was not prepared for, was being pushed by the Obama administration to help the Clinton campaign. Because if they could liberate Mosul before the November election, they were hoping that this would somehow benefit the Democratic Party. It might sound ludicrous to a Western audience, but it's what a lot of Iraqis believe.
In his work for the UK's Jane Information Group, Flood provides a window into where conflicts are headed. He says what he sees is analogous to too many cooks in the kitchen, which has to do with globalization.
You'll remember in sort of the early 2000s, there was all this fawning over the rise of China and the rise of all these middle powers, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, Turkey, Indonesia, all these sort of middle power nations. Well, where we are today is that these middle power nations are they are executing and exerting their own foreign policy in their sort of respective geographic neighborhoods. And this is what we're seeing in Iraq and Syria, where we've got Turkey and Iran, to a lesser degree Saudi Arabia, as major players. And then you have minor players, Jordan, Lebanon's too fractious to really be called a player politically. But yeah, so you... American foreign policy is not syncing up with Turkish foreign policy. American foreign policy is directly at odds with Iranian foreign policy. So these policies are both competing and also dovetailing simultaneously. So there, you know, and when I was, you know, interviewing militia members in Iraq, there are some people that want to work with the United States, some people that outwardly despise the United States, but all of these forces are in the same theater. We're all operating. And Syria is much more complicated because there you have the Russian military operating. And you have the Iranians operating more openly in Syria.
Diplomacy?
Diplomacy today is, you know, I feel that the sort of American foreign policy is not that well equipped to handle how complex these conflicts are. As I stated during the panel, these aren't binary conflicts. It's not... And I don't even want to make a Cold War cliche reference, but these aren't. So, when George Bush made his infamous "With us or against us," you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. That was an ode to the idea of a binary conflict, which is something of a myth, actually, because even, you know, World War I and World War II weren't binary conflicts. Vietnam was not a binary conflict, but things were portrayed after the things were sort of portrayed in a binary sense, you know. And so, but this doesn't reflect the reality today because globalization has integrated the world in a way that no one was ready for. It's not, you know, it's not the end of history. It's sort of the beginning of a new history.
Flood says the U.S. is more successful militarily than it is with diplomacy. And while some interests of the U.S. and Iran intersect, a cohesive plan to fight these wars is really difficult because of issues including lobbying in Washington and U.S. politics in the electoral cycle related to Israel and the Iran nuclear deal. You can see photographs and read more from war correspondent Derek Henry Flood by going to the-war-diaries.com. Meanwhile, in Syria, as the fighting continues over Aleppo, Russian President Vladimir Putin offered a unilateral humanitarian pause for the area. The Syrian rebels quickly dismissed Putin's initiative. Kenya says it's pulling out its troops deployed to South Sudan as part of the UN peacekeeping mission after UN Secretary Ban Ki-moon fired the force's Kenyan commander. Ban made the decision after an independent investigation sharply criticized peacekeepers' response to deadly attacks in July, this on a UN compound housing 27,000 displaced people in South Sudan's capital. In other international news, South African President Jacob Zuma is facing growing calls to resign after the release of a state report that found possible evidence of corruption at top levels of a government whose leader has been enmeshed in scandal. The report by a state watchdog agency came as thousands of South Africans demonstrated for the removal of Zuma. He apologized earlier this year after the Constitutional Court said he flouted the law in a scandal over millions of dollars in state spending on his rural home. Tensions continue between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. Pakistan withdrew 6 diplomats from New Delhi, and Pakistani officials said they had uncovered an alleged network of Indian spy agencies working at the Indian embassy in Islamabad. Last week, India expelled Pakistani diplomat Mahmood Akhtar from the embassy in New Delhi after detaining him on espionage charges. Within hours, Islamabad retaliated by expelling Indian diplomat Sujil Singh. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Turning to local news, while some city officials would have you believe stop and frisk in New York City is no longer a looming factor impacting communities of color, advocates for police reform like Darian X, a youth organizer with Make the Road New York, say this is not so.
And what being a youth organizer means, it means that I'm on the ground working with young people of color that come from neighborhoods all across Brooklyn. It means that I am accountable to those young people of color. It means that every day, every week, I hear the youth voices and experiences about their interactions with the NYPD. It means every day and every week, I hear about how our young people are brutalized and traumatized by the police department in our city. How they watch themselves, their friends, their family members, their peers, be harassed and dehumanized by the police department on a regular basis.
Darian X says regardless of what people are told about the number of stops being down, communities of color still hold the trauma of regular police abuse and police violence.
We understand that our communities are still being targeted, that our communities are still under attack, and that's why having youth voices here present, a part of these forums, is so important, because true reform is not going to come from the institution. True reform is going to come from the people who are experiencing this violence, who are experiencing this oppression on a daily basis.
Police reform advocates gathered at City Hall today to announce public forums set up throughout the city to gain input from community members as court-ordered NYPD remediation moves forward. Darius Charney with the Center for Constitutional Rights was one of the lead attorneys in the stop and frisk case, Floyd versus City of New York.
Since the trial, the federal monitor has been working with the parties, the police department, to develop some changes that the court specified a few, you know, very concrete changes. Some of those have been approved by the court. They're starting to be implemented, but a lot of the other ones haven't even begun. And the other piece of it was that the judge said very clearly, I want to hear from the communities who have historically been the most harmed by this practice, because they have ideas. And that's what this whole joint remedial process, that's what these forums are designed to do. It's to get their input. Because, you know, she said, I mean, I'm not going to read the exact quote, but she said that those communities have a real distinct perspective that no policing expert, no academic can substitute for, because these are folks who have lived this. And so they're going to have really unique ideas about the ways that reforms are going to impact their own lives. And that's what we want to hear from.
Charney says information will be gathered at the forums.
At each of these forums, there are going to be note takers who are going to take down the ideas that get discussed and developed. And that information is going to be provided to the facilitator, that was a person appointed by the court, and his team. And that eventually that information will go either through the facilitator and his report, or we will make sure it gets to the judge. Because at the end of the day, there are going to be specific reform ideas that are going to be proposed, and the judge is going to have to decide whether those should also be ordered, and the NYPD should have to implement those. And so that's why it's important to really get a written record of what is discussed at these forums.
Gwen Carr, Eric Garner's mom, speaks out for Our Communities, Our Solutions town halls.
Eric was murdered by NYPD after an unconstitutional stop. We are announcing Our Communities, Our Solutions, so that we could bring the effective communities out and bring them to the forefront for a court order process. Our Communities, Our Solutions will be a forum in the neighborhoods across New York City, and they will organize by different community organizations.
Carr went on to cite statistics which show that discriminatory policing continues. In the first two quarters of 2016, 83% of those stopped were Black or Latino. 77% of the stops resulted in neither arrest nor summons. This was not very different in 2015 or even in 2014. That's when 80% of those stopped were Black or Latino. 80% of the stops resulted in neither an arrest nor a summons. Less than 1% of stops resulted in the recovery of a gun. Carr says it's up to community members to speak out and participate in upcoming public forums. Will DePoe is a leader with DRUM, DACY's Rising Up and Moving, with Indo-Caribbean and South Asian working class members. DePoe says he has been stopped and frisked many times by police, once leading to an arrest.
It was one of the most traumatic experiences of my life. In 2006, I was 17, and I was on the subway platform when three cops approached me. I was told to follow them upstairs, and they demanded my cell phone. Not thinking much about it, I handed them my phone. They looked through my photos, closed my phone, and then told me to turn around. My rights were not read, nor did they tell me why I was being arrested. I was scared and confused. They told me in the car why I was being arrested, but it made no sense. While in jail, the officers, who were not from my community, used racial slurs that caused the most pain for my community. They threatened me, trying to make me confess to something I didn't do. Even though I was released and the case was dropped, it didn't stop the nightmares and the feeling of the cold metal around my wrist for months. I was told, as many of us are, if you do the right things, such as go to school, get good grades, you'll be fine. False.
Depot says he can't erase the experience of what he went through, but Community Solutions Forums offers the opportunity to fix what's wrong into the future. Drum will host the first town hall forum in Queens tomorrow evening. Brooklyn Councilmember Robert Cornegy comes to the microphone on the steps of City Hall with his 12-year-old daughter.
I represent Bedford-Stuyvesant and Northern Crown Heights. And today, while we're here talking about police reform, there's a larger looming criminal justice reform that has to be looked at. So the work that the City Council is doing with Jemani on, you know, Rikers Island reform, because this whole thing has to be dismantled. So police reform is an incredibly important issue, but the way that our children and young people of color are winding up in the system, never to be able to come out again, is incredible. As I stood on the side, my daughter whispered in my ear, she asked me, do I think the police kill us because they're scared? And I have to explain to her that that's only one part of the equation, is their fear. The other part is racism. The other part is bigotry. The other part is this prison industrial complex. So there are so many complex reasons around which we stand here today. But I remain committed as the co-chair of the Black Latino and Asian Caucus to lend whatever we can to this fight and argument around legislation and around rallying. So while, you know, it's a double-edged sword to be here, I'm glad to be here to see so many people who are interested and who have committed their lives to reform, police reform, criminal justice reform, because it's gonna take all of these voices and people from all different vantage points. And what I'm hoping is that I don't have to rely on this generation to continue this saga, right? Because as a 12-year-old, to be asking those questions is incredible. So I'm tasked now with riding home and explaining to her the complexities of criminal justice reform. And in my lifetime, I'd like to be able to change the narrative and turn the corner on what's necessary. So I'm here today to lend whatever support that's necessary to continue in moving the needle forward as it relates to changing the narrative from the police department and from the criminal justice system.
Brooklyn Councilmember Robert Cornegy with other police reform advocates at City Hall today announcing public forums throughout the city, the first one beginning in Queens tomorrow evening. An online engagement portal opens on November 7th. Go to communitysolutions.nyc. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. On the campaign trail, Hillary Clinton made a surprise stop at an early voting location in a Caribbean American neighborhood in South Florida. She was mobbed by an enthusiastic crowd in a parking lot in the town of Lauderdale. Clinton's campaign is pushing hard for supporters to cast ballots early, particularly in Florida, the biggest battleground state up for grabs. And so is Trump, who has also been campaigning in Florida repeatedly. 29 electoral votes are up for grabs in Florida. $125 million has been spent in general election presidential ads, the most of any state. Clinton has more than doubled the amount of money that Trump has spent on the air in Florida. Of course, Trump has been receiving free media attention. The Trump campaign's major play is to white voters, from the conservative panhandle to working class inland areas to the state's huge senior citizen population. The hope is that a big turnout there could counteract Clinton's strength among the state's growing Latino population, and that there will be a depressed turnout from black voters in cities like Orlando, Tampa, and especially Miami. Meanwhile, Democrats are increasingly concerned about the black voter turnout after some early voting numbers showed a drop-off from 2012. That was when President Barack Obama was on the ticket. If that decline holds true, it complicates the party's path in other states, too. This includes North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. On Thursday, Bernie Sanders campaigns with Clinton in North Carolina. There, they will encourage North Carolina voters to take advantage of in-person early voting. North Carolina has 15 electoral votes. 20 are available in Pennsylvania, 16 in Michigan. In our listening area, there are 29 electoral votes in New York, 14 in New Jersey, 7 in Connecticut. These states are seen in the Democratic column, which gives voters who may be voting for Clinton as a vote against Trump the opportunity to vote third party. Last night, The Nation magazine held a symposium on media malpractice in the 2016 election. Author and journalist Faray Chedya, who works with 538, said she advocates strategic third-party voting.
But first of all, I always make a distinction between strategic third-party voting, which, for example, might be voting for Nader in New York versus voting for Nader in Ohio. It's like, pay attention to what the heck is going on. When and if you don't want to be a strategic third-party voter and you want to be a, you know, no matter what third-party voter, that is your choice. But some people don't even understand the distinction between being sort of a purist third-party voter and being a strategic voter. It's like, I will vote for a third party if it's not going to upset this apple cart. But just overall, I'm not a fan of the two-party system. And I think as America continues to become more diverse, not just racially, but ideologically and economically, I don't see how we're going to fit all of the interest in American politics into two buckets and do it successfully. And right now what you have is that you have essentially the, you know, the alt-right and the retro-right wing of the Republican Party and the establishment Republican Party all having to fit into one Republican Party, and it's not pretty. And I don't know who's going to be the Republican Party on November 9th. Like, who is going to be the Republican Party? Is it going to be Breitbart? Is it going to be Paul Ryan? Is it going to, I mean, like, who's even going to be the party? So this is, you know, this is a structural problem, which unfortunately would require, I mean, I don't know that we can, you know, I don't know that we have the will to remake America as a multi-party democracy. I highly doubt it. But this is going to continue to cause problems for a long time.
Joan Walsh is national affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine. She says this election has been painful and unsettling for many women.
Because there's such blatant misogyny, not just against Hillary Clinton, certainly against her, but, you know, I think about when Donald Trump talked about Megyn Kelly with blood coming out of her wherever, and I spent that weekend feeling like, my God, you're Megyn Kelly, you're at the pinnacle of right-wing television, you're very accomplished, you're very smart, and someone is still saying this about you. And we've just had week after week of shocking and horrifying things from Donald Trump, but also from his supporters. And I think that there's really, I mean, there was, Vox had an interesting piece today, but, you know, again, your attitudes about race heavily determine whether you support Donald Trump, but your attitudes about gender too. So we will have a backlash. We're already having a backlash. And I think the only thing that I know to do about it is to talk about it and to call it out when we see it. And to know it's there and not to be made crazy, like, oh, you're just imagining it. Why are you so sensitive? But I would say one positive thing is that, and I wonder if others agree with me. Maybe I'm being too positive, but I think that some men on the left have gotten it a little bit better in the last few months. I really do. I've had more conversations where they seem to be really taking it in. You know, just the kind of abuse, for example, that women take on social media, where a male Democrat or a male progressive, you know, certainly gets in lots of arguments, but a woman is immediately told she's ugly, she's stupid, she's fat, she's old, she should be raped. It gets worse from there. But I feel like the ugliness that this election has brought out has enlightened some men. So that's my hope.
Walsh says she doesn't want people to underestimate the changes coming out of this election.
I mean, I think that we really may see the Republican Party experiment with evolving into forming a third party, because I don't know that there's room in the party for, you know, Steve Bannon. And I'm not going to give Paul Ryan any credit as like some kind of serious person with a moral compass, but Mitt Romney, I don't know that he's still somehow he's better to me. So there's that could happen. But I just don't want people to miss the extent to which women and African Americans and Latinos and gay people have taken over the Democratic Party. And the influence of the Sanders folks on the campaign was extraordinary. So, you know, people, this is our party now. There still are corporatists, there still are lobbyists, there still are people that we have to fight. There's going to be a real need to hold Secretary Clinton's feet to the fire around her appointments and make sure she doesn't fill offices with Wall Street folks. There's a risk of that. I'm not saying she's perfect, but we do have more of an infrastructure to make those things happen. So people shouldn't be despairing about it.
Laura Flanders, who moderated the panel, said that's a good question for another panel. Is this our party now? The Nation Magazine Symposium on Media Malpractice and the 2016 election was held at the New School in Manhattan. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.